Hello and welcome to The Lesson. My name is David Cowlishaw and in my day job I'm a teacher. But in this podcast I allow my guests to teach me about anything they like. No matter how obscure or unusual the topic, my guests will give a lesson on their specialist subject and you and I will be their attentive pupils. How they want to run their lesson is entirely up to them. All I ask from you is to leave your preconceptions at the metaphorical classroom door, settle down and enjoy the lesson. For this episode, my guest is academic Dr. Sasha Garwood, who will be teaching us about early modern women and self-starvation.
Right, hello, Dave podcast listeners. I am here. My name's Sasha Garwood. I'm an academic at the University of Nottingham. And I'm also married to Dave's friend Tone, which is why I'm here. And I'm here to talk about, kind of, the history of women and self-starvation. Specifically in the early modern period. Like, I can actually talk about the history of women and self-starvation, like, from 1500 onwards, but it just gets tangly and I end up talking about Victorian literature and swearing and, like, I mean, I might end up swearing anyway because that's, like, a thing that happens, but, like, I'll do my best to kind of make it for a reason. There are a couple of things I would like us as a collective to bear in mind before we start. One of which, and this is a big deal, is that the body is not a natural transhistorical object. The way in which we experience our bodies and our embodiment is and has always been fundamentally shaped by the ways in which we understand them. Thinking specifically about the early modern period, one example would be cancer. There's a really interesting book by a lady called Alana Skous, who I've never met, but I follow on Twitter. Called Worms, Wombs and Wolves, where she talks about the constructions of cancer or canker in early modern England. And she has a really interesting selection of accounts in which people literally witnessed, because they believed that cancer was like something that ate the body out from inside. And there are all these accounts of people like holding meat over cancerous sores and then literally seeing wolves like leaping out in order to get to the meat. The way in which we experience our physicality is fundamentally determined by our understanding of it. Another good example would be pregnancy. In the early modern period, you weren't considered to be pregnant until your child had quickened. That's not really a term that has any modern equivalent, but I would guess it's roughly analogous to when your child starts to move. So if you had like an early miscarriage, for example, you didn't feel as though you were kind of miscarrying a baby, you just had like an extra big period or something. So that affected obviously the way in which kind of people understood pregnancy, understood their own physical experiences, all that kind of stuff. So obviously this also ties into the way in which kind of people experience their bodies, their body size, their body shape, all the rest of it. So that's thing one, not a natural transhistorical object. The second thing is that our modern sense of the body as kind of almost a product, like the fact that like the shape and size of our bodies is something that we should control and is kind of like the index to ourselves in a way, that is a very recent modern capitalist basically concept. To an early modern person, I mean, their body was less of a product than a tool. Right. Like, so on the one hand, kind of you weren't necessarily thinking about your body as like an end product in itself, but you're thinking about your body as basically something that you did things with, whether that was your job or whether it was display if you were wealthy or whether it was like a reproductive tool if you were a woman, something like that. The second thing is that our moderns, one of the things that is true is that beauty, ideas of beauty used to be larger than they are now, like kind of this the kind of very very slim ideal body is a very modern like post-60s invention, but also that kind of doesn't really matter. I mean, it's useful because, like, it's useful that we have evidence that in receipt books, which are the books that women used to keep about their household, you had recipes to make your body smaller if you were felt to be kind of too fat, but also to make your body bigger if you felt to be too thin. The idea that kind of like a healthy medium was generally what people were going for is, you know, it's kind of useful. But also, clothing used to structure the body in a much more profound way than it does now. The shape of your body was not... And that, as it was seen by people outside you when you were clothed, wasn't really determined very much by the shape of your body at all. It was determined by the undergarments that you were wearing. I'm talking about the early modern period, so I'm going to talk specifically about the clothing then, but there was like a lot of women were wearing stays, they were wearing padding. The shape of both women's and men's clothes was largely determined by kind of internal structure, not the shape of their bodies. Like, if you're interested in this, look up costume historians. There are loads of YouTube tutorials about this kind of thing, talking about the way in which you make the underwear and all the rest of it. All of which is to say that when I talk about early modern women refusing food, starving themselves, refusing to eat, I am explicitly not talking about anorexia as we would understand the term. Like, we have a concept that belongs very much in our modern cultural context of eating disorders and of anorexia as something that's about resistance, but that's also about conforming to a capitalist cultural landscape, which expects women to prioritise the well-being of others above themselves, to control their food intake so that they look culturally appropriate, so they maintain a culturally appropriate body size. And that cultural context just sort of like doesn't really apply. I mean, it doesn't speak to how early modern women experienced their bodies, and it certainly doesn't speak to the reasons for which they stopped eating. So, bearing this in mind, body not a natural transhistorical object, and the modern capitalist body's product just not being a thing, I will now talk for... How long do I have, Dave?
As long as you want.
Okay, I will now talk for what's hopefully going to be 5 minutes, but may end up being longer, about my research into women who refused food or starved themselves in the early modern period. I'm going to talk about a couple of examples. Most of these examples are royal or noble women. They were people who had a lot of money, who were kind of fairly important in the social hierarchy, who because of that were expected to produce children. That was like an important... They were dynastic tools in terms of their social function. But also, they were not living on the poverty line. Like, subsistence, like starvation was practiced by much poorer women, and particularly women who were living in very poor communities, who were very subject to bad harvests. But that was kind of a different thing, because obviously they were living in an environment in which kind of lots of people didn't get enough to eat anyway, right? If you had a bad harvest, people literally starved. That was a thing that happened. So it was much easier for kind of culture and more widely to interpret that behaviour when it happened to poor women as something that was basically an act of self-sacrifice. And they were divinely inspired to stop eating. And this was a sacrifice that they were making, and it would make in order to help the people around them. It would help their communities. It would kind of, it made sense in terms of femininity as a kind of like an essentially kind of caring identity. However, the women that I'm going to be talking about didn't have any of that, because they were not belonging to a class where starvation happened anyway. They belonged to a class where basically the entire social system from the word go was geared towards making sure they got enough to eat properly. Like, they owned estates, these estates were farmed, and they had really complicated systems of cleaning and cooking and domestic service that ensured that they were well fed at all times. However, if you are a woman who have grown up in this kind of environment, and you have been raised from a very early age to believe that you were an important dynastic tool for your family, that you had a duty to marry and to reproduce and to establish your own household. And also in the case of women like Arbella Stuart and Catherine of Aragon, that you also had a major political role to play in the future of the country. One of the things that you did when you found that none of that stuff was happening or was happening in the way that you wanted it to be, one of the tools that you had available to you was stopping eating, because that sort of brought the whole system shuddering to a halt at the same time as giving you a profound sense of control over something that was missing from your everyday, life. It's worthwhile pointing out that, like, the link between modern anorexia nervosa and control is also something that's been written about and spoken about a lot, and I can go into that in great detail in the questions. But it's important to bear in mind that the women that we're talking about had lives that it was very difficult for them to control in any other way, because everything was political. The two women I'm going to talk about, I think, I'm just picking them at random, but I think that they bounce quite well off one another, is Catherine of Aragon and Arbella Stuart. Catherine of Aragon was the daughter of, I keep wanting to say Ferdy and Izzy, because what I call them to myself, Ferdinand and Isabella of Castile and Aragon, who were the most Catholic kings in the 16th century. So she had a very Catholic family at a time when the Reformation was sort of maybe beginning to happen. It's a whole thing. We'll get on to it.
The Spanish princess, Catherine of Aragon.
Sois de mi sangre.
Do you need to know what rests on you?
La auténtica infanta de Castilla y un día, reina de Inglaterra.
The hopes of Spain and England.
I'm not a child. I'm Princess of Spain and Princess of Wales.
I hoped you'd be like your mother, wise and brave as a man.
Did your mother never tell you what was done to bring you here?
I know my duty.
I'm a Spanish princess, sent by God to marry the future King of England and bring peace, and that's what I shall do.
So she was raised in this profoundly religious family. Her mother and, in fact, her sister had a history of self-starvation as religious practice, because one of the other things that was going on at this period, particularly with Catholics, was fasting as religious practice. And for Catherine, this is something that kind of turned out to be quite significant in her earlier life. At the age of, I think she was about 13, she was betrothed to Arthur, who was the son of Henry VII, and she had to go over to England. And this was kind of a culture shock, because she was going from the Moorish palace of the Alhambra that was beautiful and had running water and fresh fruit and loads of lovely things to London, which was rainy and muddy and covered in shit, literally, and had a diet that was largely kind of based on like meat and wine if you were wealthy. In fact, kind of, we have a letter from Henry VII to Isabella, Catherine's mother, saying you need to accustom your daughter to drinking wine before she arrives, because we don't drink water over here. So there was this big kind of diet change that happened. And then she arrived, and then she was married to Arthur, and then kind of they like didn't consummate the marriage, you know, the whole thing that the Reformation hinges on. I think they didn't consummate the marriage. Doesn't matter. That happens. And then she was married to Henry, which... I'm skipping over massive bits of history. Listeners who know something about history, I apologise for all the stuff I'm skipping over. It's just like, you know, the political history of the early to mid 16th century is not like my focus here. And then kind of she married Henry, and then Anne Boleyn happened, and then kind of the Reformation happened. All that stuff. Anyway, when she was married to Arthur, she stopped, just soon after her arrival in London, she stopped eating. And she stopped eating. Like, we don't have her account of this. We only have the ambassadorial accounts and the letters that were sent between Henry VII and like the Pope and her family saying, why won't she eat? In the end, kind of what happened was the Pope wrote Catherine a letter saying, actually, I'm grotesquely caricaturing Latin here. I apologise for this. Saying basically, like, you need to eat, you need to have babies. Your husband's right of your body and your dynastic role is more important than your personal devotion. She was constructing her self-starvation as her personal devotion, you know, her religious practice, because that was the religious practice she'd grown up with. And then the Pope, and you couldn't argue with the Pope, you know, if you were a Catholic, you know, that wasn't going to work, was just saying, no, okay, start eating again. And this is something that we see kind of coming up repeatedly with Catherine and also with Mary, particularly after the breakdown of Catherine's marriage to Henry. And her time is kind of like Princess Dowager. Because she and Henry were continually wrangling over the food that she was allowed to eat. And then she had this thing where kind of like, because she wasn't prepared to accept a role as Princess Dowager, she literally holed herself up with her women, and they prepared the food. She didn't have enough to eat. Like, so food is something that we see reoccurring throughout Catherine of Aragon's life as a way in which for her to negotiate hierarchy, status, all the rest of it. Now, for Catherine, and to some extent Mary, who just inherited this behaviour but manifested it slightly differently, it was easy to explain this away as religious practice, because it was a traditional Catholic religious practice. Fasting was something that her mother had done, her sister had done. Like, there was a cultural space for her to articulate it. However, for other women, I'm thinking now, I'm skipping forward like maybe 40 years, and I'm going to 50 years. I can't count. I'm sorry. I'm a historian. I don't do maths. Arbella Stewart, in an expressly Protestant context, that didn't apply. And her self-starvation was interpreted by herself and by others as an exclusively personal form of resistance. Arbella Stewart was, she was the daughter of the Duke and Duchess of Lennox, who were, basically she was, when Elizabeth was on the throne, kind of next in line probably was James I, and kind of after that was Arbella Stewart. There's some wrangling over who was the oldest brother or sister at various times in history. It doesn't really matter, and we all know James I inherited anyway, so whatever. But Arbella Stewart was, she was raised as royal, basically. Her grandmother, Bess of Hardwick, raised her with royal expectations. She was taken to court. Elizabeth kind of spoke about her as an eaglet of my own kind, and she will be mistress hereafter. Like, she had good reason to think that she was going to be, like, at least be welcome to court as an heir, if not kind of named, be Elizabeth's heir presumptive. However, this kind of didn't happen. She spent a long time holed up in Hardwick, actually, in Derbyshire, up until the time she was about 28, in 1603, just not having any access to any of the things that she had expected her adult life to be. Like, she wasn't married, she didn't get to have kids, she didn't get to run a household. She was living with Bess of Hardwick, and Bess of Hardwick ruled her household with a rod of iron. You didn't argue with Bess of Hardwick, even if you were her granddaughter. It's very noticeable that kind of all the letters that were sent around this time have Bess of Hardwick talking about my house, my gates, my this, my that. Like, she was very much kind of in control and dominant, whatever Arbella's kind of dynastic heritage. And in 1603, there was this whole scheme where she pretended she sent to I'm trying to miss out all the interesting historical stuff, but actually it's really cool. She did a bunch of stuff which involved kind of faking like a secret engagement and then tried to have a real engagement, which didn't work out. And in the aftermath of all of this drama, which is fun and exciting, and I would absolutely encourage people to look up if they are interested, she stopped eating. And in this case, it was deliberately constructing it as an act of resistance. Her letters talk in a lot of detail about not letting anything past her lips, about kind of maintaining her body as a fortress. And Bess was very aware of that. In her letters, she talks about how kind of she's aware that Arbella is so willfully bent that she refuses to eat in Hardwick or where I am. So for very preservation of her life, I've been forced to send her to a house of mine called Oldcoats that's two miles from here. So kind of she's literally, despite the fact that she spent her entire adult life in Bess's house doing what Bess says, and by starving herself, she had managed to like carve out this little bit of autonomy and like living in a different house and having her own space to kind of make choices. And again, so this is something that reoccurs throughout her life. Elizabeth eventually died. Like, it was 1603. Elizabeth was literally about to die, which is one of the reasons why all of this stuff and the fact that she was suggesting that she was having a secret affair was so important and traumatic. Elizabeth died. James inherited, kind of because Cecil had decided that James was going to inherit, and, you know, that was probably a good judgment call. Arbella went to court. Actually, I mean, she had a fine time at court, but James I was a twat. I mean, James I is always a twat. I loathe James I. But she wanted to get married, and she asked him repeatedly permission to marry. He refused to. They had this conversation where Arbella thought that actually she was saying, "Yeah, absolutely, you can marry any of my any subject of the crown as long as you ask me first." And he thought that he was saying, "You can't marry at all." Personally, I'm on Team Arbella here, obviously. But there was certainly some confusion. She made a secret marriage to William Seymour, who was currently third in line to the throne. Good dynastic move, really bad tactical move, because James I was not happy, and he imprisoned them. He put them both in the Tower. And at first, there was loads of exciting stuff happened, and Arbella escaped in drag, and William escaped, and they tried to get to France, but William was slower, so Arbella went back for him, and she got captured, and William didn't, and it was all terrible. Anyway, after that, she was put back in the Tower, and she stopped eating again. And again, this was quite useful, and she was moved north. She was also ill. There's something underlying here about whether or not Arbella was porphyriac, and therefore when she wasn't eating, she was actually her porphyria was preventing her from eating, as well as it being kind of like a, and the extent to which she was psychologically in control of this, nobody knows. I don't know. Nobody can know. So this is one thing that was going on. She was also ill at this time, and she was being kind of like moved north, and she didn't want to be moved north. And so she starved herself, and that enabled the escape thing. Anyway, this story has a really depressing ending, because she was put in the Tower, and once she was in the Tower, because she was married, she was no use to James I anymore. Like, it wasn't a popular move, putting Arbella in the Tower. There was, you know, we have quite a lot of popular resistance. And I don't know if anybody knows the Duchess of Malfi, but arguably the Duchess of Malfi was kind of inspired by Arbella Stuart and all the rest of it. So, like, even though it wasn't a particularly popular move to like imprison Arbella, he did, and she died basically of starvation 8 years later, 1615. There was absolutely something going on in terms of self-starvation was the thing that historically in her life had actually enabled her to have autonomy, had enabled her to make choices, had created kind of space for her to be herself. But now, despite her dynastic position, none of that was working. So. Do we have any conclusions? I mean, I have many conclusions. I'm just going to try to sort of like sum up my entire book in a sentence. Women starving themselves, like, because women are so profoundly culturally associated with food, because of breastfeeding, because of a whole bunch of things, there is kind of a cultural line between kind of women, like both women as food to be consumed and women as kind of the providers of food. Women who starved themselves, particularly in the early modern period, were sticking a big spoke in the middle of that and fucking shit up. And that wasn't particularly popular. It was also, however, like, it was a really powerful gesture. It upset people. The reason that Arbella managed the negotiations that she did were because she was prepared to do that. She was prepared to put her body on the line. And her body represented her fertility, like her dynastic potential, all the rest of it. She was prepared to like stick a spoke in those wheels and say, actually, no. And that is something that is really interesting. There are echoes here of concerns with modern anorexia about kind of control and like what Sylvia Plath describes as like the fig tree moment, you know, but that's kind of a very different conflict to the ones that like somebody like Arbella or Catherine of Aragon were facing, in that their lives were mapped out for them. And actually that, they weren't able to access everything they'd always been told that they might be able to access. So, yes, all this stuff is interesting. Women and food, it's cool. I think that's about it.
Sasha, that was absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for that lesson. A whole lot of stuff to unpack and sort of get into there. First off, just as a point of clarification for listeners who aren't historians, when we mean the early modern period, what years are we talking about here?
Oh God, no! Oh, that's actually a really interesting question, because people argue about this shit.
Historians argue about everything, pretty much forever, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, when I say early modern period, I mean probably like 1500s, 1700s. Like, traditionally, like, some people go from 1485, like Bosworth Field, to 1688, the Glorious Revolution. I tend to go kind of a bit later, but Catherine, 1500s, 1700, basically.
Okay. Right. Yeah, I seem to remember having a textbook at uni with 1500 to 1700 on it, but historians will argue that, I don't know, Tuesday wasn't on Tuesday if they can get a decent debate out of it, I suppose. So one of the sort of things you brought up there was this idea of self-starvation as a sign of autonomy and control, and I think this is the really fascinating thing I found from it, because when I told people I was going to speak to you about this, I got a lot of sort of grimaces and ooh, that doesn't sound very pleasant. The idea of self-starvation isn't a pleasant idea, but you've given examples there of how it sort of led to these women asserting autonomy, control, however you want to put it. So how did you kind of go about discovering that? Is that something you knew beforehand, before you researched this topic, or is it something that you've found out in your research that this wasn't sort of this wasn't something perhaps imposed upon them, if you like?
When I started looking at it, because it was something that kept coming up. I'd always known that I wanted to work in the early modern period. It's always kind of been my thing. Ironically, I finished this book and then kind of buggered off and started working in the Edwardian period, but that's just because, like, who needs an easy life? I was used to encountering self-starvation in the writings of, like, the early Quakers, for example, or in, the writer of the Tragedy of Marian. Elizabeth, Lady Falkland, had this horrible marriage to a horrible man, and like when her marriage got really bad, she used to kind of stop eating, and she'd live only on toast for days, for weeks, and we have this kind of recorded in like a biography made by her daughter. And there are a lot of kind of what I've called starving maiden pamphlets published in the early modern period repeatedly. So kind of this was stuff that kind of kept coming up, and honestly, when I came to writing a PhD about it, I was sort of significantly influenced by the fact that if I looked at royal women, then we have the archives, right? Like their letters survive, like ambassadorial reports about them survive, like we have a paper trail. And I was anticipating, honestly, like self-starvation is this fantastic, well, I mean, obviously not fantastic, don't starve yourselves, guys, you might die, but it does have this kind of multivalent cultural significance. And so I was expecting, when I started looking at it from the point of view of royal women, whose lives on the one hand were, you know, they weren't risking kind of starvation from subsistence. They were important and well-fed and all the rest of it. I was anticipating finding kind of something different. The important thing for me in my work has always been to distinguish an early modern cultural context from a modern one, because a lot of people who don't kind of work in this area tend to kind of like assume they're the same, and they're sort of not. I'm not sure if that answers the question.
I'm pretty sure I think I answered I asked five questions for the price of one there, so it almost certainly covered at least three or four of them. Tangentially related to my last question, I would ask how you came to get interested and then start writing a PhD on this topic. What was it that sort of sparked your interest?
Partly I kept finding it and nobody had done it, which is genuinely really important if you're starting a PhD. It was a toss up between this and the Earl of Rochester, and this was easier to fund. Not the AHRC funded me in the end, actually, it was this whole thing. But I mean, that's the obvious answer. The other answer is the fact that, like, I myself have a history of anorexia, and I figured that if somebody was going to be working on that, then it needed to be somebody who had like a visceral physical understanding of the physiological impact of self-starvation, because I felt and feel that I would be able to at least understand some of the physiological function of self-starvation in a way that somebody never experienced them wouldn't. Of course, kind of like that sort of comes with a side loading of like, am I just projecting my experience back into the past, which is always a danger when you're kind of looking at people who have similar situations to you. But I mean, I've been very careful not to do that, as hopefully my book would demonstrate. But B, we're all always doing that anyway, right? Like, none of us can escape either our personal psychological context or our historical context when we're kind of looking back at the past. That's just kind of something that all of us as historians have to deal with. So I figured it was worth a shot.
So to what extent do you think the women you've spoken about were... I think I'm assuming, obviously, that they knew they were taking a tremendous risk in doing this, in starving themselves. But do you think they knew quite how dangerous it was from a medical point of view? Did that sort of medical knowledge exist? In its most simplistic form, you'd assume that everyone knows that if you don't eat, you die. But how common was it? How common a practice was it, do you think?
Okay, I think that's two different questions.
There is.
I'm going to answer it. I'm going to answer it two different parts. To what extent did they know? They lived in a society in which lots of people were living at subsistence level, and people died of starvation on a fairly regular basis. So even if they hadn't, and even though they lived on kind of like big estates, those estates like encompassed like villages and towns, and so kind of they would have seen and known people and in fact animals starving to death over hard winters or whatever, like that's the thing they would have been aware of. In terms of how consciously aware they were when they were practicing, I don't know. I don't feel I can vouch for that. But I think what is significant is that I don't think it mattered. And they had reached the point that actually... One of the things I talk about extensively in my book is self-starvation as an actualized refusal of the future. There is a phenomenologist called Maurice Merleau-Ponty who wrote... he wrote The Phenomenology of Perception, and it's this huge seminal text, and I don't understand most of it. So, like, don't ask me to gloss Merleau-Ponty. But he did have he does have one chapter when he talks about kind of self-starvation. Now, he'd had this one patient who was a girl who'd been forbidden to see the man that she was in love with, and she stopped eating, and eventually she negotiated with her parents, then she was allowed to see it, and she started eating again. He talks about self-starvation as an actualized refusal of the future, how the swallowing symbolizes the movement of existence. Like, by taking things into your body via swallowing, you are accepting not just kind of like that food, but also the possibility of moving on from that food. Because, you know, when you eat, you're nourishing yourself, you're giving yourself energy, all of that stuff. So when you stop eating, you're refusing to do that. And one of the reasons why one might refuse to do that, particularly if you're a woman and have traditionally had kind of like maybe less control than men have maybe over their autonomy, is because you don't want the future on the terms that which is offered. And that's something that kind of comes up again and again. Normally, by the time women are starving themselves, they're doing so because they will not accept the future as they are experiencing it. They want something different. And if that means probably death, that's better than continuing in their present circumstances, which is something that has a lot of echoes kind of across the centuries, I think.
Yeah, and on that then, you sort of hinted in your lesson about the maybe historical parallels we can draw between sort of more modern conditions like anorexia nervosa and self-starvation for noble women in the early modern period. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about what parallels we can draw between the two.
I would love to. Just bear in mind I'm likely to talk for 20 minutes and you'll have to cut it down horribly afterwards.
That's fine.
So I apologise for that. Okay, so there are lots of parallels we can draw in terms of like impulse control, physiological effects, because actually the physiological effects of self-starvation have been kind of like studied in quite a lot of detail. There's an experiment called the Minnesota experiment in the late 40s, where Ansel Keys took a bunch of conscientious objectors and starved them and then refed them at different rates and monitored their mental health throughout this process. And he had this, one of the things that's been demonstrated is the fact that starving yourself and in fact kind of engaging in the refeeding process has a number of profound physiological effects. However, modern anorexia nervosa. So the ICD-11 and the DSM-5, which are the kind of most recent versions of those, have actually kind of like fractured the diagnostic criteria for anorexia nervosa and associated eating disorders, but significantly anorexia nervosa, hugely, since I started kind of writing this project. However, most of them still refer to a focus on the body's appearance and a desire for specifically slenderness as like externally manifest. One of the things that is missing from early modern self-starvation is about that. Like, you can absolutely draw parallels in terms of psychological circumstances, in terms of a desire for autonomy, in terms of a desire to refuse the feature on the terms that it's offered, in terms of a feeling of like the inability to cope, in terms of kind of needing something to control over. All of those, you know, you can look at these women in kind of frankly quite traumatic situations and see echoes across there. But what you can't actually do is transpose backwards the diagnostic criteria that are actually about kind of what the body looks like and relating kind of the self to a wider aspirational model of the body, which is actually important in... I mean, I kind of wish it wasn't. In my ideal world, eating disorder treatment would be engaged with explicitly on the basis of the individual, and it would take the form of like an awful lot of kind of in, like talking therapy and working with the individual to kind of figure out kind of what's driving, what their particular motivations are, what their needs are, kind of the way in which kind of they might find their particular situation and kind of giving them other coping mechanisms, all of that stuff. But that's the kind of stuff that only really makes sense in a modern context. A lot of these things only make sense in a modern context. The desire for autonomy is obviously a huge driver, but modern women, like, one of the things that's happened over the last like 20 years is that rates of eating disorders have not only kind of exploded, as in there are more of them, but also they've been found in many kind of more diverse groups. I mean, to some extent, they may in fact always have been in that those diverse, apparent in those diverse groups, and people just haven't looked because they didn't expect them. But we now have kind of like many more people who have eating disorders, different ways in which people might feel trapped by their circumstances. Traditionally, eating disorders have been assumed to belong, you know, a wealthy white woman's disease, basically. And actually, even if that had ever been exclusively true, it is certainly no longer exclusively true. But I think kind of there is a line of people feeling there, that you can absolutely draw a line of continuity about people being trapped by those circumstances, whether they are a wealthy white person who is having Sylvia Plath's fig tree moment and doesn't know if they want to do any one of these things, or it's somebody who's growing up in poverty and doesn't have access to the education or the opportunities that they might want, or if it's an early modern woman who actually would quite like to like marry, exercise power independently. I mean, I don't think any early modern noble woman would actually even consider really having choice over who she married, like, or marrying for love or anything. That just wasn't a thing that would happen. But like, marriage would, although of course kind of Arbella did, and we all know how that turned out. So early modern women's opportunities for exercising autonomy like were actually, again, like very, very limited. And there is a line of kind of continuity there. But that is contextual in ways that may resonate with the modern period, but you can't transpose one on top of the other, is what I'm trying to say. And the same with kind of using the body as a tool for self-assertion or for kind of like self-definition or whatever. That's another kind of line of continuity, but we have to kind of bear in mind that early modern women were doing it in one cultural environment, we're doing it in another, and we do have this idea of the post-capitalist body as product, and that somehow our bodily size and shape is an index of our worth, and you get those good awful diet ads promising that you can be yourself, only better, as if like being smaller is somehow inherently better. We have a whole bunch of cultural bullshit that they didn't, and that's also important to bear in mind.
My final sort of question on this topic would be about that cultural bullshit then, because right at the start you said bodies as a thing to be controlled is a capitalist concept, and you sort of alluded to it just there, but how did that come about? How has society changed the way we view, or how has capitalism changed the way we view bodies?
Well, the idea that the body is somehow a product is absolutely is one thing. Okay, so this is big and tangly, and there's a couple of different ways in which I want to approach it. The first way I'd like to approach it is in terms of literally historical events and dress, right? If you were a woman in, like, say, the Edwardian period, at the beginning of the 20th century, you would be wearing corsets that would kind of shape your body in a particular way. Then, like, this is kind of, you know, GCSE stuff. Mm. Like, the First World War happened and lots of women were working in the fields, and kind of like, so after that they didn't want kind of such definite underclothing and all the rest of it. So one of the things that's happened kind of like over the 20th century is the ways in which clothing has traditionally structured the body has just kind of fallen away. So kind of modern clothes, because of kind of modern materials and also the absence of structural underlayers, our clothes are cut much closer to the body. You can see the shape of the body to a much greater extent. Therefore, instead of being able to present a fashionable silhouette by dint of making some clever underclothing or like changing the shape of your stays or adding some padding in your butt or whatever, our bodies are much more on display. So that's one of the things that's happened. And with that, because kind of aspiration has kind of always been a thing, right? Beauty ideals have to some extent always been a thing, although they've been manifest differently and like propagated differently. And like that's, you know, obviously these things are hugely diverse. We live in an age of unprecedented mass media. We have access to images and like to realistic close-up images in a way that an Edwardian person just wouldn't have. And an early modern person certainly wouldn't have. Like if we're going back into the early modern period, you're looking at like woodcuts and like maybe paintings, and you'd be able to see the paintings if you were wealthy and you could afford to commission somebody to paint them. It's just a completely different cultural environment. So we have what Susan Bordeaux calls the empire of images. Like we are looking at images of ourselves, of other people, the whole time in ways that other people weren't. Our bodies are much more on display because of the way in which kind of clothes have changed. We are also subject to, I mean, all the things that capitalism does in terms of you really need, like, you need to work all the time and you're never quite, you're never quite kind of catching up with yourself. But also kind of the amount, you are somehow obliged to be productive, and not just to be economically productive, but also to be kind of productive in like a wider context. And along with that comes a bunch of ideals about like self-determination and restraint and kind of self-control and being able to take charge of your destiny. Like I'm caricaturing, but like these values of independence and like independent family units even are things that an early modern person just kind of wouldn't understand, because they would see themselves as like part of a household and part of like a much bigger team and like part of a hierarchy. And the way in which we see ourselves and our relationships to others has also fundamentally changed. And all of that has brought like a focus on the body as somehow like an index of our worth, even without kind of talking about maybe like changes in the way in which kind of sexuality has been discussed and portrayed and represented. All of that stuff brings like a focus on the body that early modern people just wouldn't have had. And even somebody like in the Edwardian period wouldn't have had, because they didn't have like the internet and newspapers and images and advertising. And I mean, they had advertising. Sorry, I don't mean to say they didn't have advertising, but like it was line drawings a lot of the time. Yeah. You know, it wasn't kind of photoshopped images of like a real person with their waist 2 inches smaller and all the kind of. And also, this seems really obvious, but we are encouraged to look at real people naked a lot more than early modern people were. Like, there are lots of early modern paintings featuring naked women, but they are often goddesses. Like, they are not somebody that you're supposed to be comparing yourself to, or somebody who is basically a human in the same way that you are. I mean, there's a certain amount of, like, blurring over, kind of, you know, like, at the Restoration Court, for example, like, there are pictures of, like, possibly Nell Gwynn with her tits out, like, you know, very kind of low-cut dresses and all the rest of it. But we are encouraged to look at and compare ourselves to other people in a much greater state of nudity than anybody earlier. And that's also capitalism, because it wants you to feel bad and then sell you shit. That's just how that works.
Dr. Sasha Garwood, we are running out of time. I'll just ask you, finally, as someone with a lot more sort of historical interest than just what you've spoken about today, and interests outside of history as well. What made you choose this topic as something to talk about? I know you did have a list of 6 or 7, but what is it about this topic that sort of compels you and interests you? What's the fundamental thing about it that you find so fascinating?
Well, partly people just don't know about this shit, but also kind of all of us, women, and to like an ever increasing extent, men, are absolutely asked by culture to somehow work on our bodies to make ourselves better, and that shit pisses me off. And so I thought, looking at the ways in which kind of historically people have dealt with these concerns and giving some historical context would be like a useful way of equipping people to be like, well, actually, maybe this is just all a lot of bullshit, which is important.
Yep. And that's a good a reason as any. Dr. Sasha Garwood, thank you so much. If people want to follow you or read your books, where can they get them from?
Oh, I'm Skull Beneath on Twitter. Feel free to follow me there. Like, you could buy my book, but probably like only if you're a millionaire, because academic publishing is a complete fucking shit show. Give me 2 years and there will be £15 accessible paperbacks available, hopefully. But at the moment, like, it's on Amazon, but it's £90. Nobody wants to pay that. Like, ask your library to request it. That's a thing.
Okay. Thank you very much.